This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the July 1988 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is In the Light of the Holy Herb by Vince Andahl. This is crazy, thought Mark. What have I got myself into? He stared at the speedometer needle as it climbed past 60. Steven, he said, don't you think you're pushing it? I mean, I'll just shut the fuck up and enjoy the ride. I know what I'm doing. Mark cringed as Steven pressed the pedal to the floor. They hurtled ever faster through the darkness, up the winding mountain road at 65, 70, 75 miles an hour. The old Plymouth didn't have any windshield or windows. A steady stream of night air came rushing through it, whipping Mark's long hair and beard wildly in all directions, flicking him in the eyes so he couldn't see the road ahead. Why, oh, why did I ever agree to go in on such a nutsy deal? This Steven, whoever he is, he's got to be some kind of lunatic, and I don't even know the other guy's name. Mark glanced over at the Rastafarian who sat next to him in the passenger seat. The buffeting wind flailed the Rasta man with his own dreadlocks, but his bloodshot eyes appeared imperturbable, unshakably calm, ancient and wise. Either that or he was too high to care. Faster and faster, the old Plymouth accelerated up the incline, screeching on two wheels around the curves, its revved-up engine roaring, its headlights dancing crazily through the dense thickets of tropical foliage on either side of the road. Gravel rattled like buckshot against the undercarriage. Stephen eased back on the pedal just enough to take the Plymouth around a hairpin turn without rolling it into the jungle. Immediately the road narrowed, petering out in the middle of a clearing. Mark flinched as Stephen stomped on the brake pedal. The Plymouth skidded sideways across the sodden soil and shuddered to a halt in a tangle of greenery. For a moment, the three of them just sat there, soaking up the sudden, pervasive silence. The only sound was the faint whine of a mosquito, protruding into the car through the windshield hole. The tip of a fern frond tickled Mark lightly on the cheek. "This is the place, man," said the Rasta, his voice soft and melodic. He smiled enigmatically, then slipped out of the car. Mark's heart was hammering as he followed Stephen out the driver's side. He'd met the crew-cut young man earlier that evening back in the Blue Rooster Bar in Trenchtown. They'd shared a pint of house rum while they talked. Stephen had leaned across the table till his boyish face almost touched Mark's. He told Mark in an urgent, confidential, buddy-buddy whisper all about the dope deal he was setting up. Buzzing with rum, Mark had acted on impulse and not only agreed to form a partnership, but also gave Stephen his half of the money. At the time, he'd felt exuberant over his entrepreneurial cleverness. Now, he felt like a fool. He was trapped in an ever-worsening predicament, helpless to do anything except tag along and hope for the best. It was too late to back out. The two of them trailed the Rasta through the moonlight to the opposite side of the clearing. Their shoes made squelching noises in the muck. The Rasta stooped down, groped under a bush, and pulled out a big canvas duffel bag. "Blue Mountain Ganja, man." He set the duffel bag upright in front of them and knelt to open it. The pungent aroma of marijuana filled Mark's nostrils. "This herb is fresh from the harvest, not like that dried-out weed you smoke in the States." "Good shit, huh?" Stephen rubbed one hand over his close-cropped bristle of hair and leaned closer to peer into the bag. Mark just stood there, afraid to move, his heart racing with fear and excitement. True dot, ganja is the holy herb, the spirit in the plant is alive. Him Sion reason with us, him Sion enlighten us, him Sion upfill us with telepathic inspiration from the almighty Selassie one Rastafari. If the man who smoke a spliff of ganja love Jah in his heart, then the ganja be pleased and make Tatman happy. The Rasta stood up and looked over Stephen's shoulder at Mark. He gazed straight into Mark's eyes and gave him a broad, innocent, childlike smile. First, we tech the ganja and put him in the car. Then you Sion pay, I and I. We'll pay you all right. Stephen's fingers were trembling. He unzipped his flight jacket and pulled out a pistol. You dumb nigger. No, cried Mark. Don't. Horrified, he stared at the gun in Stephen's hand as it recoiled 3 times in rapid succession. There was no sound at all. Dimly, Mark deduced the weapon must be equipped with a silencer. Or maybe he'd gone into a state of shock and couldn't hear, but he could see. In the moonlight, 3 neat black bullet holes had appeared down one side of the Rastaman's ragged Bob Marley t-shirt, and mystery of mysteries, the man himself only smiled. His bloodshot eyes didn't even blink. They remained imperturbable and calm, ancient and wise. Stephen quailed back, mouth opening to scream, but at last the Rasta's eyelids closed and he toppled to one side, the dead weight of his body hitting the rain-drenched jungle floor with a squishy thud. My God, whispered Mark, you killed him. For a fucking slimeball hippie, you catch on quick. Stephen sneered and pointed the gun at Mark's head. Maybe I should waste you too. Part of Mark wanted to turn and run. Another part flared with anger. Maybe you should, he snarled. You lousy, no good son of a bitch. Faster than Mark would have thought possible, Stephen lunged forward and jabbed the barrel of the gun at his mouth. Mark felt his lips split, a tooth shatter. A lancet of pain shot up through his gums and explode in his forehead. He staggered back, bending over at the waist, fumbling at his face with both hands. His fingers felt wet. Numbly, he pulled his hands away from his mouth and looked down at them. His hands were smeared with blood. He held them cupped to catch more blood as it fell from his lips and dribbled off his beard. On the ground, slime ball, now! Mouth throbbing, head spinning, Mark sank to his hands and knees. Down all the way, slime ball, on your stomach! The voice sounded metallic and unreal in Mark's ears. He hesitated. Something struck him in the side, knocking him face first into the muck. Oh my God, he shot me! He shot me! Okay, slime ball, just lie there flat. That's right. Now, pull your arms in under your body and keep them there. You know what I want to do to you now, Slimeball? I want you to reach down and grab your balls and hold on to them tight, real tight, because I don't like hippies, Slimeball. I've never liked hippies, especially old hippies. And if you so much as move a fraction of an inch, if you even breathe hard, I'm going to blow your fucking brains out. Mark's mouth had gone numb, but the pain in his side was excruciating. He gritted his teeth and tried to lie still. Concentrating on the pain, he decided it must have been caused not by a bullet, but by a hard kick in the rib cage. One or two of his ribs might be cracked, but he hadn't been shot. None yet. Let me tell you something, Slimeball. With all that scummy hair, you look like some kind of goddamn filthy animal. If I want to look at the animals, I'll go to a zoo. I don't need no fucking hippies. Stephen's voice gurgled and hissed with hate, rising in pitch. I bet you ass fuck your dog, Slimeball. I bet you pick your nose and eat it. I bet you roll your shit up into little balls and play with them, don't you? Don't you? Don't you? Don't you? God help me, thought Mark. With a cold rush of terror, he comprehended fully what Stephen was doing. It had been relatively easy for Stephen to kill the Rasta, because the Rasta was just a Jamaican, a black, a zero in the killer's warped hierarchy of values. But to murder Mark wouldn't be so easy. Mark was an American, and a white man, too. Before Stephen could pull the trigger, he'd have to work himself into a psychotic frenzy, and he was doing that by hurling obscenities at his victim. Please, please don't kill me, Mark spoke in a hoarse, pathetic whisper. Panic had constricted his voice box. I won't tell anybody. I promise I won't. He hated himself for begging. It was the lowest thing he'd ever done, but he couldn't prevent the words from squeaking out. Please, I don't want to die. He couldn't go on. His jaw had locked. Through his clenched teeth, he sobbed and whimpered like a baby. Involuntarily, his hands curled into claws, raking deep into the mud. All the muscles in his body contracted, tightening till he felt like a piece of metal being subjected to a pressure test. To his amazement, he realized he was literally paralyzed with fear. If he tensed any more, his spine would snap. He heard Stephen chuckling, the little metal pressed harder against his scalp. Suddenly, a loud buzz sounded inside his head, growing in volume, droning in his ears, drowning out the sound of Stephen's demented chuckle, and plunging Mark into darkness. At the last moment, the shrinking window of his conscious mind identified the buzz. It was the same noise you hear when you stand up too fast from a squatting position and make yourself pass out. Somewhere, an engine roared. Mark's mind came spinning up out of the darkness. He guessed he'd been unconscious for only a short time, 20 or 30 seconds, perhaps a minute at the most. With a groan, he struggled to lift his head and look around. Through a swimming blur of moonlight, he saw the old Plymouth back out of the ferns on the far side of the clearing. Stephen sat in the driver's seat. As he turned the junker around, he rubbed his crew cut and leered at Mark. Good luck explaining this to the Kingston cops, Slimeball. With a shout of laughter, he revved the engine and gunned the Plymouth across the clearing, driving it straight over the Rasta's body. Mark saw the duffel bag full of ganja bounce up and down in the back seat. Twisting his head, he watched the taillights shudder and lurch down the road out of sight. For a while, he just lay there on his stomach, too weak to get up. Finally, he struggled to his feet and stared blankly off in the direction the car had departed. That bastard. By the time I report this, he'll be country. I don't even know what Stephen's his real name. I'll wind up getting blamed for the murder, and he knows it. Mark's upper lip felt like it had swollen to the size of a golf ball. Stabs of pain shot up from his broken tooth into his sinuses. Blood and dirt had bedraggled his beard. His rib cage throbbed. His features were completely, almost serene, the Rasta. He looked like a supine saint. He'd been at peace with himself and the world when he died, and too little time had passed for rigor mortis to pull his mouth back into a sardonic grin. Mark leaned closer. The Rasta's lips appeared to part. His nostril hairs trembled. Was it just Mark's imagination? Or was he the guy's chest rising and sinking, moving almost imperceptibly up and down with shallow inhalations? Holy shit! He's still alive! What am I going to do now? Mark stood up, crossed the clearing and started down the road, walking as fast as the pain in his side would allow. "Gotta hurry," he told himself. "Gotta find a doctor or a nurse or somebody who can help the poor guy." Briskly, his legs carried him down the road away from the Rasta. "Who are you kidding? You're not going to look for help. What you want to do is bustle back down the mountain to your hotel room and pack your bags and get the hell out of Jamaica before anyone asks you any questions. You're running, so you won't get just like Stephen. There's a man back there who's dying, but you don't care. You're too scared to stay and try to help him. Stephen's right. You're a slime ball." He willed himself to stop. He stood there in the darkness, not knowing what to do. His legs shivered. The cowardice inside him was like a physical force. He felt it straining inside his muscles, compelling him to rush away from danger. The only thing that held him back was an image in his mind, the floating, moonlit memory of the Rasta's face. "I can't just leave him there. He needs help, and he needs it right now." With a shiver, Mark turned around and retraced his steps. He stood over the Rasta, staring down in helpless confusion at that saintly face. "So what am I supposed to do? He's been shot in the chest. He's been run over by a car. I never learned anything about first aid in my whole life. I'm a complete idiot on the subject. I don't even know how to put on a goddamn bandage." Mark crouched down next to the Rasta. He had no idea how to proceed. An urge to leap up and run away surged through him, and he struggled to control it. "Do something," he told himself. Instead, he hesitated, hating himself for being so fearful, so incompetent, so totally incapable of action. Finally, he willed himself to work his hands under the Rasta's back and pry the man up from the muck he was stuck in. The Rasta groaned when Mark hoisted his chest. Mark groaned too, then peeled up the blood-smoked Bob Marley t-shirt to inspect the man's gunshot wounds. There were three of them, all right, just as he remembered. The holes ran up the left side of the Rasta's chest, far enough off-center to have missed his heart. His left lung must be torn to shreds. I wonder, are there any other vital organs on the left side of a person's chest? The spleen, maybe? Or the kidneys or the liver or something? The Rasta's eyelids opened slowly. Solemnly, he gazed at Mark's face. Then his eyelids closed again. He took a breath with a soft, burbling noise, and a froth of blood bubbles trickled from the corner of his mouth. Mark stood up and looked wildly around. The clearing wasn't very large. Dense jungle enclosed it on all sides. Some farmers or somebody must live up here. Otherwise, why would there be a road? Maybe there's even somebody who has a phone or can tell me how to get one quick. He circled the clearing. On the far side of the road, he found the start of a path. He ventured a few steps up the path, cupped his hands around his mouth, drew air into his lungs till the ache in his rib cage stopped him, then shouted as loudly as he could, "Help!" It came out at half the volume he wanted, an insubstantial squeak of a shout. His larynx was still tight, not only from the terror he'd felt a few minutes ago, but also from a new fear, the fear that by crying for help, he would attract someone even worse than Stephen. "Don't be so goddamn paranoid," he told himself. He took another breath and shouted, "Help!" again. This time his voice sounded even weaker. For a long time he stood as still as possible, listening for a reply. He heard the clickety-clack of a flying beetle and a noise that sounded like the croak of a frog. Mosquitoes whined around a puddle on one side of the clearing, but otherwise the jungle was silent. He tried once more, shouting the same message over and over again, up the path and in other directions too. Help! Someone's hurt! We need a doctor! Each time he filled his lungs, the sore spot in his rib cage hurt worse. Each time he shouted, his voice sounded thinner and hoarser, and the great darkness around him refused to answer. Finally, the pain of an especially deep inhalation made him choke. Instead of shouting, he reached down with both hands to hold them like a compress against his sore ribs. But when he touched the spot, the pain screamed through his body, sharp and agonizing, and his knees nearly buckled. Look at your fingers. In the moonlight, they glistened with moisture. He held them close to his eyes to make sure. That's fresh blood. I'm wounded down there. A kick wouldn't make me bleed, not even a hard kick. Stephen must have shot me, just like I thought. My God, he really did. I've been walking around with a gunshot wound, and I didn't even know it. How bad is it? I'm not gonna die, am I? He didn't feel like he was dying. The wound hurt like hell, but he knew it had to be superficial. The bullet must have just grazed his side, ripping open the skin and fracturing a rib or two, but not penetrated deeply. You're going to be okay, he told himself. Just calm down and try to think clearly. You've got to figure out what to do. He walked back to the center of the clearing and knelt next to the Rasta. The man was still breathing. Mark rose and turned slowly around, studying the perimeter of the clearing. It occurred to him now that shouting for help had been a silly thing to do. The surrounding jungle was too impenetrable, too wild. Surely no one lived anywhere within shouting distance of the clearing. Probably the path had been made by animals and men. And the road, whatever purpose it once had served, the road was now defunct. For all he knew, it had been abandoned years ago. During their ride up the mountain, the last mile or so hadn't looked or felt like a road at all, more like a trail of ruts that the jungle had encroached upon and would soon overgrow. He walked to the downhill side of the clearing and stared down at the road. How far would he have to walk to get down there before he could find somebody? He remembered seeing some roadside shack just below the switchback, but how far was that? Desperate with indecision, he walked back to the center of the clearing. He glanced down at the Rasta, then up again, searching the tropical gloom for a solution, then down again. He looked hard at the Rasta. Pushing his broken tooth with the tip of his tongue, he wondered what to do. With a start, he realized he was wringing his hands together like a fretful mother. His tongue touched an exposed nerve, and the tooth screeched with pain. A pulse of nausea ripped through his body, dizzying him. He stared at the Rasta. You can carry him down the mountain. You can carry him down till you come to one of those shacks. It's the poor guy's only chance. Mark stooped down and grabbed the Rasta under the armpits, but when he pulled up, the wound in his side exploded like a bomb. He screamed and dropped the Rasta. Bent over to a hunched position, he waited for the pain to subside. You idiot! You absolute idiot! Finally, the fire in his ribs died down. With infinite caution, he straightened his back and stood upright. He wiped away the tears from his eyes, wishing he could just as easily wipe away 40 ruinous years of dissipation, ennui, and despair, and start his life over again. Wouldn't it be great to be a kid again, to be back home in Omaha, going to high school and griping about his parents and saving up his allowance for Friday night dates? What a waste he'd made of his life since then. Suddenly, he heard something. At least he thought he heard something. He couldn't be sure, but it sounded like voices murmuring in the distance. They ebbed at the edge of stillness. Then he couldn't hear them at all. Slowly, he walked across the clearing to the path and stood there straining to pick up the voices. When at last he heard them again, almost subliminally, they seemed even farther away. By God, there really are people up here, but it sounds like they're heading off in the wrong direction. Help! We're down here! We're hurt! The words came croaking out of his throat in a raspy whisper. He wanted to shout, but couldn't. His rib cage hurt too much, and his larynx wouldn't cooperate. No one's going to hear that pitiful squawk. What you got to do is go up there after them, and you better do it quick right now, before they get too far away. He started up the path. The foliage formed a canopy overhead, shutting out most of the moonlight, making it difficult to see where he was going. After a minute or two, the path narrowed. The darkness closed in around him, and he came to a halt. This is crazy. What if I get lost? But then he heard the voices again, somewhere above him on the slope. They still sounded faint, but not so far away as before. This time he discerned a melody of tiny variations in volume, tone, and cadence, and guessed there must be at least three or four speakers engaged in a lively conversation. Who are they? What if I take them back to the clearing and they don't believe my story? What if they decide I shot the Rasta? What if they're his friends and he dies? They might kill me. They really might. His legs shook. Trying to save the Rasta was pointless. The man didn't have a chance. One of his lungs was torn apart. He was drowning in his own blood. It made so much more sense for Mark to just turn around and hike back down the path and down the road too, all the way back to his hotel room where he could shower and change clothes and take a taxi to the airport and catch the next flight back to the States. Why the hell should I risk getting murdered? Or worse yet, getting stuck in some filthy Jamaican jail for the rest of my life? I haven't done anything wrong. Not knowing which way to go, he stood there and listened to the voices above him on the mountain. There was a lilting rhythm to their conversation, a kind of gentle music in it. Come on, Mark. It may be a long shot, but trying to save that Rasta is the only really decent thing you've ever done. You can't quit now. With a new surge of determination, he forged up the path, pushing aside the fern fronds, squishing his way across beds of wet moss, stepping over knotty tangles of roots, moving steadily but slowly enough to keep the wound in his side from screaming with pain. Each time he paused, he could hear the voices more clearly. Men's voices, or so it seemed, six or seven of them flowing lyrically together in what now sounded more like a chant or a litany than an ordinary conversation. Whoever they are, they must be performing some sort of ceremony or something. There aren't any primitive tribes in Jamaica, are there? Mark pictured a big black stew pot surrounded by cannibals with tattooed cheeks and sharpened teeth, then hurled the absurd cartoon image out of his mind. You dummy, where do you think you are, anyway? In a Tarzan comic book? He rounded a big tree stump with fungi growing on it, ascended an embankment, then found himself standing on level ground. There were no trees here to block the moonlight. A multitude of leafy plants surrounded him, each one about 8 feet tall. A rich odor flooded his nostrils. He looked more closely at one of the plants and immediately recognized the familiar pattern of its foliage, the slender elliptical leaves arranged in groups of five, the flush abundance of flower buds ready to burst into blossom. Ganja! A whole flippin' field of ganja! I'll be damned! He wasn't close enough to make out what they were saying, but he could hear the voices clearly now. One voice was doing most of the talking, while the others responded with brief but frequent interjections. To approach the voices, Mark would have to penetrate the stand of ganja. There was no path to follow. Using both hands to protect his face from branches, he plunged into the dense vegetation. In places, the growth was so thick, he felt like he was squeezing through a hedge. If it got any thicker, he'd need a machete. This isn't a cultivated field. The plants are too close together. It's a jungle, a whole goddamn jungle, naturally, of pot. As he pushed his way through the tangle of overlapping branches, clouds of pollen floated up from the flower buds, tickling his nose and irritating his eyes. He suppressed an urge to sneeze. What a smell! The female plants must be at the very peak of their potency. As he pressed on, he saw a zillion motes of moonlit pollen drifting in the air around him. He could taste them on his tongue, feel them coating the inside of his nostrils each time he inhaled. They stuck to the film of sweat on his skin, but most of all, they filled his head with a cloyingly rich and giddy aroma. He recalled reading a book about how to grow marijuana, that in Algeria, when the workers harvest kef, they have to wrap scarves around their faces to keep from inhaling the pollen. If a worker takes off his scarf, he becomes stupendously high, so high he forgets where he is and what he's doing. So high, he lies down and goes to sleep on the job. So high, so high, so high, he was floating free, floating like the pollen, drifting in and out of soft beams of moonlight, filtering down through the layers of leaves in lazy arabesques and swirls, enveloping him in a tremulous silver sea of illumination. And yes, it was true. He'd been smoking joints for 30 years, but never before had he gotten so high, so fast, and he kept getting higher, kept going up and up and up, each new breath rushing through his lungs into his bloodstream, up to his brain like a tidal wave of psychedelic energy. He took a step, and it seemed to last forever. He was acutely conscious of the way his foot lifted off the ground and swung forward, every microscopic increment in the biomechanical action of walking revealed itself to him in ultra-slow motion. During his next step, his eyes focused on a single ganja leaf at the tip of a branch. He scrutinized the blade of the leaf, the glitter of resin on its surface, the lacework design of its petiole and veins, the delicacy of its serrated edges, and it seemed that all the secrets of floral engineering, the mysteries of photosynthesis and transpiration, were his to understand in a moment of divine revelation. During his next step, he let his eyes zoom in for a close-up of another leaf. It came looming up to him out of the darkness, enormous, menacing, sheeny, and metallic, with lights like a George Lucas spaceship, perhaps an intergalactic Maori war canoe, or maybe it was just a big bronze sculpture gone green with verdigris, an abstract expressionist sculpture just sitting there in the living room of his mind. During his next step, he saw them all, thousands of the little green things looking back at him, but he couldn't remember what they were or where he was or what he was doing or even who he was. He felt like a moth or a breeze or some dismembered consciousness moving steadily deeper into an alien dream world, drawn inexorably forward by the voices of the beings who lived there. The stalks thinned and parted, and he stepped out into an open space, a clearing. A long time ago, he'd stood in another clearing, but he couldn't remember anything about it now. Now, there was only this clearing, and in the middle of it, eight black men sat around a fitful campfire. They'd let their hair and beards grow naturally into soft, ropey dreadlocks. Some of them wore white cotton undershirts with faded blue jeans and leather sandals. Others, khaki work shirts with checkered trousers, and still others, long-sleeved shirts unbuttoned to the waist with pants striped in the African colors, red and green and black. One man tended a little cooking pot by the side of the fire. Another tapped lightly on a drum. A third stood with a book in his hand. He was older than the others and wore a flag with a lion on it wrapped around his chest. He opened the book and read aloud. "And Jah said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, an herb yielding seed after his kind, and Jah saw that it was good." They passed the bamboo chillum, and smoke billowed up from the bowl of the pipe till it veiled their faces. He stood on the other side of the clearing and watched them. He knew who they were. They were his friends, his brothers, Ross Michael and Ross Kwame and Ross Darrell, Bongo Sill and Bongo Jonathan and Bongo St. I. McLean, Rasta Herbert and Aya Mortimer. Yes, he knew them, and now he remembered who he was too and why he was there. The sudden return of self made him feel light and airy, as though some great burden had been lifted from his shoulders. His side ache was gone. Gone, too, was his fear. He came forth into the clearing, walking slowly and confidently towards them. One by one, they turned their heads and greeted him with smiles and warm words. "Peace, Rasta. Love, Rasta. Peace and love, Rasta. Praises due Selassie One. Dread, Rasta. Welcome fort, Breda. Ire, Breda. Ire, Ras Marcus." Yes, now he remembered who he was and what they'd sent him to do and how he had failed. He knew they would forgive him. He'd not brought back the money they'd hoped for, the agreed-upon price for the bag of ganja. But money was of no great importance. All that really mattered was that he had returned safely to be with his brothers again on the site of the Holy Ground Nation. He smiled and sheepishly down at the picture of Bob Marley on his T-shirt, then held out his thin black arms, palm up, to show them he'd come back empty-handed. "That crazy bald head," he explained, "him pull a gun on I, and I and tech de ganja without no pay for it." "Seen," said Aya Mortimer. They handed him the chillum. He drew deeply on it, filling his lungs with smoke from the holy herb. It washed away the evil that had touched him. It cleansed his soul. He smiled and sat down on the ground. The cooking pot was giving off a delicious aroma of lentils, peas, and porridge. He was glad to be with his brethren again, glad to be home. We continue with a story from the February 1988 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is The Incredible Christmas Wish. A week before Christmas, Abby wandered away and was found by the railroad tracks near the Peninsula Ice Company, chatting with an unsavory old man. The policeman who brought Abby home described the old man as a bum, a transient, you know the type. But Abby glowered and kept insisting the man was Santa Claus. I groaned. "Come on, Abby, why don't you grow up?" Mom shot me a look of warning and held a finger to her lips. "You think I'm lying, don't you?" shouted Abby. I could barely keep from laughing. Her voice was deep for a 6-year-old's. When she shouted, she sounded like an irate frog. "Look, If she's old enough to go fooling around with old bums, don't you think she's old enough to know the truth about... I began. Go set the table, please, Marjorie, said Mom. Dinner that night was tense. Mom tried to look calm and unruffled as she passed the broccoli around, and Dab stabbed the roast as if it were his worst enemy. What on earth were you thinking of, Abby? He asked for the 30,000th time. Nothing, grumbled Abby. We thought you'd been kidnapped or something. Anything could have happened, Dad shouted, waving his fork and its captive morsel in the air. Abby drank her milk placidly. Everything's fine now. I talked to Santa Claus today. We're going to have snow for Christmas, she said. I snorted and almost got milk up my nose. Good grief, I said into my napkin. It's true, Abby returned. It doesn't snow in California, I replied, swallowing fast, afraid I'd laugh with my mouth full. And you didn't talk to Santa Claus. You talked to a bum by the railroad tracks. You'll see, she said, glaring coldly at me. She laid her silverware on her plate and turned towards Mom. May I go to my room now? For a little kid, Abby had a lot of style. She could be as haughty as English royalty when she wanted to. She sneered at me when she thought nobody was looking. I really had her going. Mom sighed and said, yes, go on. Later, after everyone had gone to bed, I crept back down the stairs in my nightgown and turned on the Christmas tree lights. I got down on my hands and knees and crawled around in the shadows under the tree, rattling gifts. I already had most of my presents figured out. There was a pair of disco roller skates and the big heavy one. There were lots of books and clothes and stuff, and I was pretty sure the long flat box had a new tennis racket in it. The really big present, though, the 10-speed bike, was still in its carton up in the rafters in the garage where Dad thought I'd never look. They were probably going to bring it out on Christmas Eve after we were asleep and put a label on it that said it was from Santa. Most of Abby's gifts were mysteries to me. I shook them and poked at them. The trouble was, Abby hadn't asked for anything this Christmas. She kept saying that all she wanted was snow on Christmas Day. I got up and looked out the window. There was a palm tree in our front yard, right next to a lemon tree full of big yellow lemons. It would be really strange to see those trees covered with snow. I picked a candy cane from Mom's carefully arranged mantle decoration and chewed it slowly. Abby was having a hard time in California. It had been over 6 months since we'd moved from Minneapolis. As far as I was concerned, our new home seemed like heaven. The other girls at the junior high I went to were friendly, even to a new kid like me, and the California boys were almost uniformly gorgeous. It was nearly January, and our winter clothes were still in mothballs. There'd been one light front so far, early one morning. Later the same day, I'd been playing tennis outdoors in a t-shirt and shorts. Minneapolis seemed like a freezing nightmare in comparison. But Abby couldn't see it that way. All through autumn, she waited for the leaves to turn color. Towards the end of November, one of the walnut trees down the street finally turned brown and the leaves fell off. The owner said it was because it had a disease. Since then, Abby had been waiting stubbornly for the first snowfall. She wanted to build a snowman, and she wanted to go ice skating. She kept asking when the pond in the park would freeze over. Now there was this business about Santa Claus and the white Christmas. I really hated to admit it, but I was beginning to think my little sister was totally out to lunch. I turned off the tree lights, put the candy cane back in the arrangement with the eaten end inward, and sneaked back up the stairs to bed. A couple days passed. One night we went down to the mall to do a little last-minute shopping. Mom wanted to get a box of cheese for the mailman, and Dad wanted to get some special golf balls for his boss. While they were at Macy's, I was supposed to take Abby to see Santa Claus, who was sitting at the center of the mall inside a little white cage made of garden trellises. We stood in line for a while. The really tiny kids were all too scared to sit on his lap. A lot of them were screaming. He kept saying, "Ho, ho, 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 ho." Once I saw him look up at the ceiling and roll his eyes. It must have been an awful job. When we were third in line, Abby looked at me and said very loudly, in her deep voice, "Is it okay if we go now? I thought you wanted to see Santa Claus. I was trying to be nice to you," I said. "Look, I know the real Santa Claus when I see him, and that guy's a fake," croaked Abby. "So no phony Santa Claus is going to make a fool out of me." A whole bunch of people turned around and started staring at us. I thought I should die. I grabbed Abby by the arm and led her away from the crowd. "I don't believe this," I said, trying to keep my voice down. "You still think that old bum was Santa Claus, don't you? Just because he wasn't wearing a red jacket and boots doesn't mean he wasn't Santa Claus." Her eyes blazed like two miniature fires. She was convinced, completely, totally convinced. All at once, I hated that bum. Abby and I were still arguing when the four of us got in the car to go home. I wanted to make her see the truth about the bum by the railroad tracks. Most of all, I wanted to keep her from being disappointed on Christmas morning. Finally, Dad told us both to be quiet and if we couldn't see anything nice, and I had to give up. Abby wouldn't budge. At 5:30 on Christmas morning, Abby padded softly into my bedroom. It was still dark. As I snuggled in my warm blankets, I could hear the pleasant thrum of heavy rain outside the window. Abby shook my shoulder. "Are you awake?" she whispered. "No," I groaned and hid my head under the cover. "It didn't snow," said Abby very softly. "Can I get into bed with you?" "Huh?" I sat up and looked at the clock. "Don't you want to go down and see what Santa Claus left for us?" "No, I don't feel like it anymore," she sniffed quietly in the dark. "I want to go home." "Oh, Abby, come here." She climbed up on the bed and got in under the blankets. Her feet were like icicles. I hugged her and she cried, covering her eyes. I hated playing the game. Somebody should have told her the truth long ago. Then none of this would have happened, but I knew this wasn't the time for major truths. I felt sorry for her. Sometimes Santa just can't give us everything we ask for. He has to do what's best for the most people. If it snowed, a lot of palm trees and fruit trees would die. Maybe the water pipes would even freeze. They don't even have snow plows here, believe me. There'd be a lot of very sad people around. Santa can't just go around making people sad. "He made me sad," she cried. "Look," I began. And just then, in the dark, quiet shadows downstairs, we heard the front doorbell rattle, followed by the unmistakable squeaking of hinges. A prickle went up my spine. "What's that?" I whispered. "It's the front door," hissed Abby. Her eyes were wide. I jumped out of bed, grabbing the closest heavy object I could find, my terrarium. At the head of the stairs, we could hear the noise of the rain coming through the open door. In the dim morning light, we made out a dark figure standing by our Christmas tree. I gathered my courage and stepped forward quickly, flipping on the living room light. "What do you think you're doing here?" I blurted. My voice was high and squeaky, and I felt like a fool. The man turned towards us. He had on a battered gray hat, a threadbare overcoat, and a worn-out pair of soaking wet sneakers. His wrinkled face was framed with white hair, and a long white beard, straggly and dripping with rain. Under one arm, he had a big brown box. "It's him!" cried Abby. "It's Santa Claus!" "What are you talking about? It's a burglar!" I shouted. "Mom! Dad!" The old man laid a finger across his chapped lips. He set the box hurriedly under the tree, then doffed his hat and said, "Merry Christmas, Abby." Then he disappeared out the door, leaving puddles of rainwater behind him in the entryway. "Wait!" shouted Abby, flinging the door open again. But the old man was nowhere to be seen. I stooped beside the brown curtain. It was made of corrugated cardboard that looked wet, but felt dry and waxy. The corners were bent and chewed. It had seen better days. I picked it up and shook it. Inside, something heavy shifted ever so slightly. "What is it?" cried Abby breathlessly. There was a label on the top, printed in ornate but rather shaky script. "Virgin Snow, a carefully blended mixture from the ice fields of Tibet." Lines of oriental writing showed faintly from the other side of the thin paper. "I guess it's snow," I stammered. I had never been so totally amazed in my life. "Snow!" yelled Abby, ripping off the sealing tape. "What's going on down there?" Mom's sleepy voice drifted down the stairway, but neither of us could answer. Inside the carton was a little wooden box with a hand-carved lid, scratched and scarred in a dozen places. It was carefully packed in steaming dry ice. In a haze of vapor, Abby opened the wooden box. We leaned forward, relishing the sudden fragrance of raw, lonely stone, frozen blue sky, winds snatched from the jet stream. I caught my breath and blinked. Abby plunged her hands in, speechless with delight. Up came a spray of frosty white crystals. After Christmas dinner, Abby drew pictures by the fire while I was out on the porch getting the feel of my new tennis racket. I overheard Mom and Dad talking as they did the dishes. "Honey," said Dad, "it was probably just shaved ice." "I suppose so," Mom replied, sounding thoughtful. "But then we don't really know what Tibetan snow looks like." Dad snorted. "Don't tell me you fell for that line. This guy's an old tramp. Where is he going to get Tibetan snow?" "You're probably right, dear," sighed Mom. "Still, it was awfully nice of him to go to all that trouble." I swung the tennis racket and thought of all the trains that go up and down California and wondered where Abby's friend might be tonight. He might be in Gilroy or Salinas by now. I swung the rapid once more. Then again, he might be at the North Pole. Now, a poem from the same issue. Salinity by Robert Fraser. Sweating in the full glare of August, my father taught me a bittersweet truth on a beach day when he was restless to beholding something other than me. A surf casting rod, perhaps, or the glow of health that eluded him and corroded year by year like his station wagon from Halide poured on New England's icy roads. He taught me that we preserved our heritage, our only heritage really, in the saltiness of our blood. "A striped bass can't live out of the sea," he said, "or in fresh water either. Yet we carry our ocean with us from birth to beyond." And as he cut short this speech, fully knowing what carcinomas ate at him, he let tears drop into the sea, spraying on me. Unmindful, I sucked the salt from my wrist. Now it haunts my veins. These molecules of his within me, that ocean within the head of a pin, they're whole ecologies of salinity, of the evolution of things once left unsaid, await evaporation and condensation and distillation, worlds reduced within worlds, lives within lives, yesterdays. We conclude with a story from the March 1988 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Late Again by Hank Searles. On his last morning, he burst from the cool cave of his communal garage into the hot Southern California glare and turned onto the 6-lane highway past the condos, heading for the freeway, knowing that if he stayed in the feeder highway's right lane, he would gain 10-12 cars before the light turned red, and even if he got caught by the light, he could peel the little RX-7 out in time to make the next one, because the rotary engine, though it lacked torque on the low end, was still going to wax the asses off the Mercedes diesel and the Dodge van that were leading the pack, and that would be corking the flow if they did get caught at the signal. So he whipped his head around to the right, not trusting rearview mirrors or even the one on the right wind wing, and floored it as he fingertipped the tight, sensitive wheel, pulling into the right lane and downshifting fifth to neutral for a shot of gas as the clutch came in, then smoothly into fourth and flooring it again, searching the side streets for the motorcycle cop with a handlebar mustache who lurked every morning trying to catch some poor bastard just like him, late for work and trying to get on the freeway before it flogged completely, because a dozen cars you pass now could turn into 50 cars maybe in 15 minutes if the 7:30 traffic from Laguna Niguel and San Clemente got onto the freeway in the meanwhile. Jesus, he'd been stalled on it once for half an hour just for taking an extra swallow of coffee, and once he'd awakened horny and banged Julia, and then handlebar had pinched him. "Yes, officer, I'm sorry," he'd squirmed like a wimp as he signed the ticket, and still been 20 minutes late and taken all kinds of shit from his supervisor. But this time, handlebar was nowhere in sight, and he made the light and squealed up the freeway on-ramp and into the slow lane, head swiveling left like a fighter pilot, out-bluffing a semi and a VW and a Pontiac Trans Am in the next three lanes to finally slide into the last one, and switched on the radio for the traffic advisories on KMPC, the extra news station, and Schultz was on about the Libyan thing and how the administration was doing it all it could to defuse the situation commensurate with the national interest, but the Soviets must be shown no sig alerts. But then, this sudden, immense flash in the khaki sky ahead over L.A., turning it sapphire blue like Julia's eyes, and taillights blossomed ahead like cherries on trees, and he jammed on his brakes as a dead white disc appeared for a microsecond over the city and burst into a mushroom cloud. "Shit!" he bellowed, before terror, fire, and shockwave in that order engulfed him. "Late again." This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.